indicate in our calendar 98-1166, State of Ohio versus Case of Rob. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is David Gray, and I represent Mr. Rob. Preliminarily, what I would like to do, if the is okay with the court, is I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Edwards, who is my co-counsel, is going to take the second part of the initial argument. I'm going to spend some time on mitigation in this case, and then Mr. Edwards is going to take the bulk of the first phase, which is the trial phase.
You need to watch your time so it gives time for Mr. Edwards.
Okay.
There's a clock there. Hopefully it's working.
It is working. The mitigation hearing has quite a few errors, a number of errors, and what I would like to do is take you sequentially through the hearing itself to determine and show you the amount of errors and how they built up to the what we call the course of verdicts in this case. And it begins with the jury instructions in the second phase and the concept of unanimity. The jury instruction is improper because of State v. Brooks and the progeny afterwards. The jury instruction states that basically that if you did not so find with respect to whether Mr. Rob is guilty of the aggravation is more than the mitigation, and if you reject. All of you have to reject that before you get to life in the face of the witness.
Doesn't it say if you are not unanimously convinced that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, then you must choose one of the two life sentences? That tells them they have to unanimously agree that life is the recommended sentence, doesn't it?
There are two concepts. The answer to your question is yes, but there are two concepts here. The first is the issue of whether when they went to life, whether they all had to reject death. And it's my opinion that under the statute and under Brooks, that this is not the correct instruction. You have stated that in State v. Gulf, which the prosecution cites, and in State v. Gulf, he said that this particular jury instruction is not correct, but because of the evidence, you let it go and you affirm the conviction.
Well, it goes on to say, though, you shall sentence to death only if you unanimously find that aggravation outweighs mitigation. The jury must have known that they had, every one of them had to vote for death, or there would be no death penalty. Doesn't that tell them that?
I don't believe so. And that goes to the second phase of this first instruction, the general instruction that was given in mitigation. The second part of it says that you unanimously have to find for life. That may be true in and of itself, but it's not true in the entire context of this case, and it's not true even with the case law. There are three alternatives, basically, with respect to mitigation hearings in the jury instructions. The first is they all have to agree to death. The second is they have the option of all agreeing to life, all 12 of them. But, and this is different in this case, this is different in capital litigation, they should be instructed that if they cannot agree on life, all 12 of them, they cannot agree on life, then two things can happen. You can either, under State v. Springer or State v. Brooks, you can force a life sentence because of one individual not wanting the death penalty. That is what did not happen in this case. And if you read it, if you read the mitigation hearing sequentially, it becomes extremely evident that they were not aware of this third most important option. And that is, again, what Springer says and what Brooks says. And that is, a single solitary juror can create a life sentence in Ohio. And what the jury instructions there were a number of questions, but one of the questions asked by Mr. Combs, the informant, was if, I believe he said, if we cannot agree on death, must we find for life? The judge then said yes to that, and he gave the same instructions that he gave in the general at the beginning.
Which is exactly why I had trouble following your argument, because if anything, this jury really understood. This jury even sent out the question saying there are 11 of us agree and one doesn't. Can we dismiss this juror? Isn't that right? And the judge said no. I mean, they really did know they had to agree unanimously or there was going to be no verdict, no death verdict. And I guess I don't understand your argument.
That is not how I read the transcript, sir. What she felt was she either had to vote for death or she had to vote for life. And the 11 jurors who voted for death initially knew that, or felt that they all had to vote for life. That's the difference in this case as opposed to any other case. The jury instruction gave them no option but either to vote for death or to vote unanimously for life. And the 20th and 30th, this was in all cases, the 20th and 30th. They can't. That is an improper instruction. Technically they are proper instructions, but they have to be supplemented with the statement, again, under Brooks and under Springer, that if you cannot agree on life 20 for life. You do not have to sign a verdict. And that is what the case law says.
So counsel, I'm trying to follow what you say. One of the jury room is you got 11 jurors committed to the death penalty. One not. 11 signing for death and one signing for life?
Obviously not.
Well, what do they sign? They have to return something to sign.
But you stated in papers,
that's the right end
of the decision. You cited the Seventh Circuit case in which you stated that if the same juror felt that he or she was alone and the other 11 were pressuring her to point out the next issue as a coercion. But so to speak, the important point is if they don't agree, if it's 11 to 1 or whatever the sequential series is or the vote is, then they don't have to sign a verdict. She thought that she had to sign a verdict in this case. There's no question about that. And if she knew that she had the option of not signing, she would not have signed.
Should the jury have been instructed that if they did not sign the verdict form recommending one version of life, that the trial judge would impose whatever sentence the trial judge believed was appropriate?
The answer to that is yes, sir. That's true. Halfway through a sidebar conference or a conference outside the presence of the jury, Mr. Dedan and Mr. Rance wrote out a supplemental chart. This was during the course of just before the Howard chart. And that was precisely what they asked Judge Mitchell to do. And he declined. Mr. Hogan said it was not the law in Ohio. That's absolutely incorrect. It is the law in Ohio. If a jury does not feel that death is appropriate, she doesn't have to sign anything. But she felt that there was no other alternative. In Ohio, there are three, there's no question under the law and under the statute,
Well, she felt there's no other alternative but to sign the death verdict.
Knows this.
Yes.
Why did she think that?
She says that in her. Well,
she gave an affidavit. She gave an affidavit. That's what they're saying.
She thought the judgment was going to give a life sentence.
She said I didn't know
way
at all.
In her affidavit that she would have signed for death. If she knew
that she was like to this is she's already had a kid.
Right.
But she had no other
choice just argue here.
And the question that you asked as far as the supplemental instruction is precisely what occurred in this case as far as Mr. Devan asking for the supplemental instruction. That's just before the hour chart was given. I don't have much time, but the jury was coerced, the verdict was coerced here. Justice Douglas stated that it was clear that this was 11-1. There is a case in the United States Supreme Court called Bradfield, which is cited in my brief, and it specifically says that if the juror and the judge know what the split is, if they know that it's 11-1, that is coercion as a matter of law. In this case, in the cases that we've done, I'm sure the court is aware of this, if a jury comes back and they say they're deadlocked, one of the first things the trial court says is don't tell me your vote, but and then he starts asking, she starts asking what, if there's any chance.
You said if the jury and the judge knows, you mean just the judge. Jury obviously knows. She's sitting there, and she's even been made privy after the fact to the note sent out saying we're 11-1. So it's just the judge that's the problem.
And then the judge responds, that's correct. But what happened in Brassfield is he asked for the vote. It was 6-9-3. In this case, it's even worse because he not only asked for the vote, they went out of their way to interrogate the jurors inside his chambers and asked him not only what their vote was, but the jurors, Mr. Collins and the others, accused her of doing what she's entitled to do in the state of Ohio, and that is not vote for death.
Well, wait a minute, he didn't ask for the note before the first. He didn't ask for the vote before the first note came out. They sent out a first note saying it's 11-1. Then they did the in-chambers interrogation. Isn't that right? So he didn't ask. Let's not say he asked for the vote. He didn't do that until he confirmed what their note said. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Okay.
The procedure is supposed to be, you're supposed to ask the judge a question, the juror. They didn't do that here. They sent out a declaratory statement saying that Katrina Fair is being obstinate. She is not. She is refusing to understand complicity. She has made these off-the-hand comments right after Vicki Schwartz's direct examination and mitigation hearing. What it did was is that the elements of coercion are so clear here. It's quite evident. They had the vote 11-1. They had the interrogation. They had people, her own people, accusing her of doing what she's entitled to do. And finally, at the end, they have a question to Judge Mitchell, and it says, if we vote for death, does that mean it's just a recommendation? And he said, and obviously he said yes, under the objection of the defense counsel. Now, if that is in pure Caldwell's specificity, it doesn't exist. They thought, and she says this in her affidavit, they thought that they were just a rubber stamp to the judge. And she says this in her affidavit, that she thought that the judge was going to vote for her.
What would you say, that the judge should have not responded at all? Because obviously what he told them was in conformance with the statute.
Except that I agree with you, except that every indication before that answer was this, again, this theory of coercion on the part of Katrina Fair and also the unclear jury instruction.
Let me see if I understand your argument, because I really am having trouble following it. Are you saying that the judge, when he answered the question, that yes, if you make a recommendation with regard to the death penalty, I can make it life? He answered that question. He answered it in accordance with the statute and truthfully. Are you saying at that point she interpreted that as saying, well, that's what you're going to do? He never said anything like that.
No, sir, he didn't. Except, under, as you know, under Caldwell, if the jury believes that your vote is merely a recommendation, and that the next step is the judge, then that takes away the constitutional importance of your verdict. My time is just about up, but the other important point in the litigation is the way the prosecutors handle this closing argument. All you have to read is Hogan's final closing argument. I believe this is improper. I think it is out of line. He calls our client Adolf Hitler. He talks about turning on the gas chambers. There is no way that a jury listening to this is not going to be influenced by someone of this man's ability. The first part of the closing argument I said was decent, but after the man's closing, he said things about the nature of the homicide and about
in response to something that the defense counsel had said?
Not for us. No, sir.
Before you sit down, I don't think that's the note the jurors sent out about the holdout jury. When the judge interviewed each juror individually to see if they agreed to that, the holdout juror had not been aware of this. Why she
I'm sorry, was she made aware of the contents of the notes?
When the judge
would have to get the answer yes to your question, after this, that they brought Mr. Combs in first, and then they brought in the next 10 for a sign of this thing, accusing her of
fighting.
Then she comes in, the last one, and she sits down and gives her notes to read it. And she reads it, she looks up, and she says, that's another important element of coercion, is that government's free.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Mr. Edwards.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Joe Edwards, and I have approximately 9-10 minutes to speak about some of the trial issues, which are contained in Propositions 1 through 2, the ones I would like to discuss. The first one deals with trial court's error in admitting what is commonly been referred to as penal case. As the court below held, this was clearly in violation of Ohio's wise act law. There is absolutely no doubt that the revised code, section 2933.5, is clear, it's unambiguous. It differs completely from its federal counterpart. The federal counterpart, under federal wise act law, only protects oral communications that have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Why let's assume that the defendant here was involved in a plan to cause a riot at Lucasville. Why would there be a presumption or an expectation by prisoners engaged in the conduct in which they were engaged of privacy of their conversation? Why wouldn't they assume that the people on the outside, all the law enforcement persons on the outside of the prison, would be wanting to know exactly what they learned by the tapes.
Your Honor, it is not our position that the defendants, the individuals writing in prison had a reasonable expectation of privacy. If we were to argue that, I think we would be on very thin ice. I'm unaware of any case from this court or any court around the country that has said that writing inmates have an expectation of privacy. However, in the light of this court's decision, State v. Finlaw, the defense's position is that reasonable expectation of privacy is not an issue here. That the statute, as this court mentioned, Finlaw, is clear, it's unambiguous, and it states that an oral communication cannot be intercepted without an interception warrant. In fact, the statute is so simple to comply with that there's a provision in the statute that allows an oral agreement from a judge within the county where the interception is going to take place, that a warrant can be obtained in writing, I think within 3 days. So for the state to simply obtain permission and to lawfully follow Ohio's interception statute would have been very simple to do during the Louisville riots.
Are you talking about the tapes that were made in the tunnel?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. I wrote Bidnost, I think, as I recall it.
You did, Your Honor.
And as I recall it, we clearly were talking about telephones and portable telephones and telecommunications, and the radio waves has nothing to do with a tape in a tunnel in a prison, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I understand that in your opinion, there is some language, I believe, that I cited in my brief, particularly where there's a phrase that you put, that you write something in effect of, fundamental rights should not be sacrificed at the altar of modern technology.
Yeah, I remember writing that.
And I think that there is part of your decision where I think that this court, and at least in your decision, that this court would hold that, contrary to much federal case law, that individuals in Ohio have a reasonable expectation of privacy when talking on, for example, cell phones or cordless phones. However, I would also submit that our position is that you are very clear in your decision where you discuss that reasonable expectation of privacy under Ohio's law, which was in effect during the Lucasville riot, that issue of reasonable expectation of privacy is not relevant to the discussion of whether or not the individuals, defendant Bidnoss, that there was an improper interception, that Ohio does not have that component within its statute.
It may sound cruel, but do prisoners really have any reasonable right expectation of privacy?
Your Honor, I mean,
that's a whole different concept that I guess I've never thought about, because you even have a way to sometimes tape outgoing phone calls from the prisoners. I mean, you know, you just don't have the same rights after you've committed a crime and been confined. You're devoid of those rights.
Your Honor, we would agree. I think that there's federal case law from the U.S. Supreme Court, mm-hmm. Hudson versus Palmer, which clearly supports that proposition. However, it appears as if when the Ohio legislature enacted Ohio's interception statute,
okay,
they provide greater protection than the Congress did in enacting the federal statute. So as a result, I mean, as difficult as it may seem, as uncomfortable as it may be, it appears that from reading a clear and unambiguous statute, as you mentioned in Bidnoss, that the concept of reasonable expectation of privacy is not relevant in this case. It's clear that it was
not phone calls taken from the paper. This was actual people speaking in a room that they were speaking from.
Well,
we said that.
That's exactly correct. I
believe it's clear that that's what it is. Yeah.
And put your ear up with a cop, an old fashioned one, and listen to this.
I remember when I wrote that case.
Your Honor, I suspect it would be
really interesting.
And the reason why
each one of your favorite subjects.
But
privacy and just.
Your Honor,
I just think you ought to have the right to privacy over the phone.
And we're arguing that the state failed to conform itself to the common law, that it intercepted oral communication through the use of electronic means. Now, I'm not aware of anything in the record. Obviously, the record in this case is quite voluminous. I'm not sure if the summary witness from the Highway Patrol, Mr. Hudson, if there was any testimony that these communications, these oral communications, would have been able to be obtained by just listening. I don't know. I believe these were like micro fibers that were stuck up through some of the cracks and crevices underneath the tunnels up throughout the walks. So I'm unaware if there's any specific testimony in which I believe that there was some testimony that their talk could be heard. But the specific communication, of course, what we're talking about here is tunnel page 61, which is the key piece of evidence. And the Court of Appeals below said that this was harmless error. And quite simply, the tunnel tapes were the best evidence the state of Ohio had in this case. In fact, the entire evidence against Mr. Robb, which indicated that he was a conspirator who was aided and abetted, dealt with the tunnel tape 61, which is Exhibit 322, which dealt with the April 15th or April 14th early morning meeting, where the state alleged that a vote was taken to kill a guard. And through the testimony of key witnesses, and we would submit that the two key witnesses in this case against Mr. Robb were Mr. Lavelle and Mr. Snodgrass. And I see my time is almost up, but it appears as if that when those witnesses testified, the tunnel tapes were played. In fact, in Mr. Lavelle's testimony, the tunnel tape was played, it was stopped, and then the state would ask Mr. Lavelle, okay, what happened here? What took place there? What did this person mean when he said that? And what's important, which unfortunately I didn't emphasize that strongly in my brief, was the fact that not only were the tunnel tapes played during the testimony being made, but it's very clear from Mr. Lavelle's testimony very early on in volume 17 that Mr. Lavelle reviewed the tunnel tapes, particularly tunnel tape 61, a number of times to help the state prepare the transcripts. So therefore, our position is that the unlawfully obtained evidence is so interwoven into the testimony of the inmates who testify that it's impossible for any court to separate out and say, well, this is just harmless error. It's clearly bolstered the testimony of a number of inmates. In fact, Mr. Lavelle pled guilty to conspiracy to commit aggravated murder. His actions were as involved as Mr. Robb, if you believe the state's case.
Is that bolstering? That's what I was going to ask you before you said that. Is the bolstering the real heart of the error here? Since the Court of Appeals found it harmless based on the testimony of Lavelle and the rest of them, they say the tapes were really ancillary, supported, but you want to say it's bolstering.
Sure. And of course, Your Honor, I have to be careful using that term bolstering, because obviously any testimony that the
right.
state uses to support its case bolsters the state's case. But here what we're saying is if you take the tunnel tapes out of the equation, all you have are a number of inmates who have extremely lengthy records that are in a maximum security prison, all of whom have cut deals to save their own proverbial debt, especially inmate Lavelle. And so not only did inmate Lavelle testify the tapes were played, but he also used the tapes to refresh his own memory, refresh his own testimony, and listen to the tapes a number of different times. So of course our position is
the tapes might have been the basis for the deals for these guys too. I mean, once the state had those tapes, everybody.
It may be wrong, yeah. But our position is it's impossible to separate out the tapes, determine those tapes, the admission of those tapes are harmless.
I have another question for you. I'd like to hear your argument on the state's argument that this is really federal. FBI they were the ones doing the taping and their protection under this crime.
Your Honor,
right?
I think the Court of Appeals addressed that issue very well. It would seem to me that the federal officials who are investigating the commission of federal crimes in the state of Ohio do not have to comply with Ohio's law. That's very clear. However, in this case, it was clear from the testimony of Special Agent Bolt, B-O-L-E-T, who testified, actually while the jury was deliberating during the mitigation phase, that the FBI was invited into Lucasville by state officials. They were not there to investigate civil rights violations. They were there primarily to investigate state law violations in the system state. And our contention is that it would completely disturb, it would completely do away with the Ohio legislature. If the Ohio legislature creates a law, and state officials can completely circumvent that law merely by inviting federal officials in and all of a sudden say, well, we're inviting the FBI to help us out here, and even though this is completely a state law violation, we now don't have to follow state law. We can follow federal law, so therefore we don't have to go out and get a search warrant. I believe that that would completely circumvent the intent behind the law, circumvent the Ohio legislative process.
Thank you, Governor. Mr. Breyer.
These issues in the same order that they were raised by counsel, and that's by Mr. Lutcher.
Sure.
With regard to the two issues that were raised regarding the mitigation phase, counsel spent a lot of time discussing the supposed Brooks violation. I've gone over this charge several times. The Court of Appeals went over several times. I believe this charge is in total compliance with the language of Brooks. The court told the jury to back up. Eric Brooks was telling the jurors that they had to unanimously reject the death penalty before they could go on to life. That was the problem. That did not happen. To the contrary, the judge told them that if they couldn't agree on death, they should go on to life. Later, when the jury asked a specific question on the issue, the judge answered it correctly. Told them, you can't agree, you must go on and return a life verdict. This charge was really in total compliance with Brooks. That's what the Court of Appeals found. There just is no Brooks error in this particular case. I don't know if there are any further questions.
As adamant as juror Fair, is it, or Fair?
Fair.
As adamant as she was, my recollection is not once, not twice, but three separate times, including the other jurors say during the trial that she'd never vote for a death penalty. As adamant as she was, what changed her mind?
Obviously, because her own affidavit could not be considered because the affidavit belonging to the students, and she listened to the Howard charge, which was the correct Howard charge, and that is completely deliberate with the jury. And in fact, it's correct what I said before, the note that came out, what it actually said about her failures, is that she just won't deliberate with us. That was just
a I wrote Howard, too, and did Howard, did he give that Howard charge verbatim?
I believe it is. The Court of Appeals has no problem with the Howard charge. It looks like a verbatim charge. But just for reiteration, the Brooks decision came out the day before this jury was charged. And I don't believe there was a Brooks objection raised at trial site. It's law. After the fact, I think that actually the judge anticipated your decision.
I know that you really can't consider her affidavit, and it might be speculation, but what about his argument that she thought that the judge was going to impose a life sentence?
There's no support for that argument, in fact, with regard to they asked, is this a recommendation? They said, well, the judge said yes. Well, the judge did say yes, but then he went on to follow by saying, however, this is no way of designation responsibility. It was a correct statement of law, so it's not a call to allow his feeling, but he went on to qualify and explain that they couldn't do that as an alibi. So I don't think there's any way you can infer that she believes that the judge would return to the life person. I think that's pure speculation.
I know it's been held that the judge does not have to tell the jury what happens if they won't unanimously sign one of the forms. Here the jury is struggling. Why wouldn't it be wise for the judge to tell the jury what the law requires if they cannot agree unanimously to sign one of the forms?
Judge, all your decisions have said that every verdict, life or death, must be unanimous. And I wish I had done this question about targeting the jury that they can come up. Because I'm always positive that one of the more recent cases you have said that the jury need not be charged that they can hang. And I think if you charge the jury that they can hang, you're just inviting people to use that as an excuse and not fulfill their duties. That would really seem to be the corruption of the jury process.
It might be anathema or contrary to even the dynamite charge that we talk about in Howard, the blast. You going to talk about Hitler and Satan?
Yes. So before you do that, staying on this subject for just a second, the note is presented to the holdout by the judge. Comment on that. That seems to me we have a note from 11 jurors who have now been interviewed to say, yeah, we all agree with the contents of this note. And the judge brings that juror and flips that note to her.
Did you ask for a comment?
I think
the judge handed this copy of the most non-coercive manner possible. Each juror said no one was singled out, even though all individuals said there was no group pressure. And she knew what was going on back there. She didn't see
that.
She was back there. And she came in, she said, hey, I'm
the liberal. That was pretty strong in terms of her behavior. Wouldn't it have been far better in terms of the court? I mean, the judge had just done a fairly narrow interview of her. And
the judge,
do you think we would continue to deliberate?
I think he did a pretty good thing. He was very gentle. And he did not remove the sound. She was deliberating and sending back. There's nothing the judge did that he considered force.
Instead of handing the note. That seems to me is a little like the teacher saying, hey, you know, all the other kids, you've been a bad girl.
You could look at it the way I don't. And she obviously would have known that. But that's not going to be a surprise for her.
Mr. Breyer, before you go to that, by my count, and it may be inaccurate, but your office and you have been involved in somewhere between 25 and 30 death penalty cases. Large number. Have you ever seen, in any other case that you've had or any that we could think of jointly, where the judge has brought in the jury in the middle of deliberations and in effect voir dired them?
I don't recall. I'm not saying it is not.
Yeah, but you don't remember any, and I don't either. Okay. I just wondered, why did he do that? Where would there be authority for that?
Both parties, Judge. You got to remember, one party was wanting the juror thrown off. The other party desired a mistrial. And I think because of the tone of the note, the judge had an obligation to look into it, and he sort of carried out his obligation.
There was something that he could not ignore in the face of that note.
Exactly. He had to do something.
He had to do something. It would be just like during the course of a trial of pure misconduct, this process of judicial attention. So it is not something that never happens.
I thought the judge's response was very reasonable. The only other matter brought up about litigation, the closing argument, I think Justice Rutherford asked me a question, commented about Hitler and Nazis. As a matter of fact, the only comment I can make is that those words never appeared in the closing argument. They were never said.
How about Satan?
Satan was said, but it was only said after the defense counsel said the state's witness is on the campus. So it was a clear, permissible response. Even though I think it was a proper response, the judge struck it, told the jury in disregard, so I don't think the error could be predicated upon. This closing argument, if you read the prosecutor's closing arguments and the defense closing argument, you're going to find the prosecutor's argument is entirely proper. The defense argument is the one that's out of bounds. The defense argument attack the prosecutors, attack the state's witnesses, misstate the law. It's the kind of thing that a prosecutor said, guys, you're trying to defend it, or we need to go ahead. The state's responses were very appropriate. The same thing is a direct response to the investor calling the state's witnesses and devils. The whole gist, Your Honors, of mitigation was that This defendant was not blameworthy. That at best he was neither the better, that there were others who were more culpable. He focused his whole argument on culpability, and he implied that people who were the hands-on killer should get the death penalty, but haters and betters should not. In response to that, the state said, that's like arguing that the people who win are not as culpable as the people who did the actual killing. That's a mild response. It's not made wrong. It's not easy. I don't think it's a proper response.
That was a little stronger than that. It talked about turning on the gas.
No, I don't recall. I think it might have said, the people in Berlin are just as culpable as the people who turn on the gas. And what I'm calling this thing is just a historical analogy. That in view of the argument, the defense is making a very appropriate analogy.
So, what does that mean?
Well, they ordered the killing, they didn't actually do it. And another facet, it's an aimer better.
Hey, no, it wasn't the residents of
the it was the leadership. Just as this man was the leadership of the crime.
So without naming the brother,
for a name definitely was not. The whole tone of the prosecutor's argument was mild and entirely responsive to the argument made by the defendant. The defendant told the jury, said, the prosecutor's here trying to kill my client. He's only a hater and a better. But you know, next week they'll go try somebody else. They'll try one of the hands-on killers, and then they'll claim he's culpable. And the state was just responding, saying, hey, it's not you before. Both are culpable. Hands-on killers and those who were, both are people culpable. That was the tone of the argument. The only other matter I wanted to talk about was the wiretap issue. I was really surprised the Court of Appeals decided as it did, because I thought it was inconceivable that you could tell rioting inmates that they would benefit from the state not getting a wiretap in a situation like this, where there is clearly no expectation of privacy in the conversations where they've already killed 10 people like that. Excuse me, they already killed 8 people at this point. They're still holding a large number of hostages.
Well, but the defendant's argument is I think, as I understand the defendant's argument, is that the expectation of privacy is not an issue under the statute, and that's a fair argument, isn't it?
No, I disagree with that.
Okay.
Our state statute incorporates as an exception interceptions that are proper under the federal statute. And under the federal statute, conversations with no expectation of privacy may be intercepted without a warrant. So the expectation of privacy issue is, in fact, important. It is critical. The Court of Appeals here kind of blew off that argument and said that exception would swallow the rule. And that's really not supported by any evidence or any rational thought. The Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals came to the exact opposite of State v. Smith. They held that the Ohio statute does incorporate federal exceptions for state officials.
You would have told that there's just no requirement, period, for
there's no requirement for more here.
And would that be true all the time? Would the circumstances here justify that conclusion in this circumstance, or in the state, for example, tap every phone conversation with any individuals?
This is a very narrow proposition that emerges. That is that the federal exception for conversations where there's no expectation of privacy is applicable in Ohio through that language in the Ohio statute. That's what the Ohio County Court of Appeals held. That's what the First District Court of Appeals held in another Ryan case. So there's two courts of appeals that come to the opposite conclusion here. One thing I'd like to point out.
So in what respect would it be limited?
It's limited to conversations in which there is no expectation of privacy.
So a telephone call wouldn't have an expectation of privacy,
would it? Might we agree with this? There's, although this issue was not raised in this, Justice Douglas pointed out there is an expectation of privacy. In fact, in a later decision, or cited from earlier decision, Larry, for the same proposition, this court in Bidmas found there was an expectation of privacy. So this really is not contrary to Bidmas at all. They conform to each other. And I don't think it's statutes allow police to get credit information, bank information, phone information. And this statute is just like this because in this statute it authorizes county prosecutors, state officials, to use procedures of federal statutes in state courts to obtain things. So we don't do that, but we have our own statute. But I don't think, because of that, I would think it's really too broad to read the Ohio exemption against the corporate expense.
So you would have all of those laws, because of that reference, led to say, irrespective of what state law does, if federal law gives you a broader scope, you can do that.
Now, see, it's not irrespective of state law, Jim, because state law says any interception proper under federal law is proper under ours. It's just an attempt to make the statute code sense. I don't see any problem with that law.
In a certain context, then, every conversation among inmates would be curbing.
I would say two things in response to that. Number one, the conversation by right inmates who have killed 10 people to see prison.
Now you're putting a whole bunch of qualifiers on that.
Sure, just like you, I don't want to be so broad. I want to narrow it to what we have.
Exactly. So that's what we write should limit it to those circumstances.
That's all you have to write here. There is no expectation of privacy. The Smith case out of Cuyahoga County involved warrantless listening to phone conversations in prison inmates. That would certainly appear to lie in the face of the sheriff's prison, unless you read the statute as well. Unless the court has any questions on any other issues, I'm going to stop here.
Thank you, Mr. Breyer. It would be great if you'd saved about a half a minute of your time.
Prosecutor seems the case is 15 minutes argument. The prosecutors will make the defense attorneys with respect to the
unanimity issue. The prosecutor stated that there was no report was signed or filed on the same day as this trial occurring. On April 4th, 1995, the defense counsel requested a specific instruction on this unanimity issue. So the rule that is found in R-144 of the record, and again it was found on April 4th, 1995.
Yeah, counsel, I'm interested in the whole balancing here of some question. Is this prosecution team correct to tell a jury up front that if you can't agree, it becomes the judge's duty to handle this. Isn't that just an invitation to say that the jury's failing on the whole deliberation with respect to the sentencing?
Well, the answer is yes to your question, but as Justice Moyer stated, that is a correct statement. Should not the judge have supplemented the instruction here because of the obvious problem that was occurring between the 11 jurors?
So your argument is not that it should have been part of the initial instruction, but when confronted with the length of deliberations and the messages coming out from the other jurors, that it was at that point in time to explain.
Correct, and you are absolutely correct. The sequence that occurred here is the thing that is just devastating as far as showing this court's verdict. It began with the improper jury instruction and ends with, again, the lack of proper jury instruction. I want to say one more thing with respect to that. The judge stated halfway through this, in the fact that there is no way I'm going to keep her on the jury. And then what probably happened was, record, you realize that on the 24th, you cannot take her off because then that creates a misprint. You can't, like I said, the same stuff, you can bring in a substitute juror and all that. Yes, you can't do that because under the statute, it's totally improper, especially in vacation. So he was left with, again, the attorney affair. And he declared a misprint. He declared, he stated that the jury is deadlocked, and Hogan instead mistake, and that word is in the transcript, not so much for the client. They said to reconsider, and finally she did, and there were like two or three notes, and finally just, this is coercion. It's pretty clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.